Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Greg Barnsdale. After a career in various end-of-life roles, Greg wrote the book about preparing wisely to die. He is a funeral director, certified executor advisor, certified financial planner, and death doula, all rolled into one. His compelling message is gaining popularity, and his following is substantial, as we will come to understand during this podcast. And with that, Greg, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the program today.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate your interest.
Well, my interest in you was stoked by another podcaster, Steve Ramone, and I know you appeared on Steve's podcast. He has a nationally ranked podcast. He introduced me to you, thought your story would be a good fit for my podcast. We had a pre-chat, and we found that I think we aligned on a variety of different levels in terms of our attitudes about being open about death and talking about all aspects of that. Mm-hmm. And that led us to this point today.
Yes, and absolutely. And I'm so grateful that Steve Ramone suggested that you and I link up.
If Steve ever sent me a bill for his services, I'd probably have to take another mortgage out on my house. But he has the interest. He's a man of service, and he wants to make sure that he's matching podcast guests with the right podcasters. And that, to me, is admirable. So let's get right into it. First of all, why did you write the book? And what is the name of the book, by the way?
The full title of the book, Dave, is Do Not Ignore Your Mortality, Practical Advice from a Funeral and Financial Insider. The reason why I wrote the book, though, was really out of frustration. When I started working in my first career as a licensed funeral director, I had worked for small and large funeral homes, but I had consistently seen situations, Dave, where so many of the families that we were serving were really unprepared for the death, and it was very difficult for them compared to the situations where preparations had been put in place and conversations about end-of-life issues and planning around them had taken place. But the majority of situations, there was very poor planning, if any at all. And then I saw the same sort of thing after about 13 or 14 years working as a funeral director. I then shifted gears. I wanted something more lively, as I sometimes joke with people, saying, and I joined the financial planning industry. And I saw the same sort of theme there, too, when it came to retirement planning.
Why are so many people just not organized or don't place a priority on financial planning? Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think a lot of people, when it comes to retirement planning and even post-retirement planning, as I call it, or estate or legacy planning, I think many people, Dave, become overwhelmed at all the information. And in many cases, it shuts them down, or they don't know where to turn to obtain good information for their particular situation?
Yeah, you know, there's another thing that has kind of occurred to me in terms of this whole topic of death being taboo in a lot of Western society is that we don't talk about it. And I tell my students at Utica University, talking about death isn't going to make you die. Yeah. It's something that we have to have an open conversation about, because that's going to be an inevitable end to our human experience here. I wonder how much of the reticence to do financial and retirement planning is based around that fear of death.
Well, I suspect there is a fair amount of fear. I also believe, Dave, that there is too much superstition involved. And it actually, it has me thinking about my situation where after a career in various roles of stressing to other people the importance of having their final affairs in order and speaking with their family about what they want to have happen, etc. And then 2 months after I published the book, I myself was diagnosed with a large brain tumor. But I don't think I brought that on, or a higher power brought that on in my life. I think it's just coincidence.
Yeah, it's kind of in terms of, you know, your belief that we should not avoid talking about our mortality, that we need to in some ways embrace that. Now you're looking, you know, at a brain tumor diagnosis. Can you fill in our listeners in terms of where you are with that prognosis, everything at this point that you're willing to share?
Sure. Yeah. I'm willing to be transparent with this, as I felt that I needed to be after publishing a book about the very topic of being prepared. But David, it shocked me. I was totally surprised. My publishing coach had suggested and stressed to me that I need to be willing to try new things and experiment in promoting my book and message. So I reluctantly did that. I posted a video on social media, not knowing if my brain tumor was cancerous or not. It ended up being non-cancerous, but I initially didn't know that. But it took me 3 days to tell my wife that I had a brain tumor. And I should have told her sooner, in hindsight. But I was shocked when I came home from being told this. My general physician didn't know if the brain tumor was cancerous or not, and he had referred me to a specialist. And by the time I got home half an hour later, the specialist's office was calling me, asking me to come in rather quickly to see him. So I assumed it was cancerous, and I was given a death sentence. So I didn't want to ruin my wife's day. I didn't want to ruin her dinner. I didn't want to ruin her night's sleep. And I kept procrastinating and putting it off. And then on the Saturday morning, as Celine Dion's song is playing in the background on the stereo, My Heart Will Go On, tears started rolling down my eyes. My wife knew I was upset. Something was bothering me and it was serious. So I told her, and she was devastated.
Yeah, I can imagine, because, I mean, the first thing is when I hear the word cancer, the one thing that comes into mind is you're either going to live or you're going to die. There's no in between. And until you know what the prognosis is with your tumor, until it's been staged or you've been biopsied, there's a lot of uncertainty.
Absolutely. And that was my dilemma. Even though I had my affairs in order and I was confident that I didn't have to scramble to update my will or update beneficiary designations or let my wife know where I kept things, because I'm the one who basically often pays the bills and organizes all this stuff. But it threw me. I didn't know what to expect, but it was such a relief knowing that I had my own estate planning affairs in order at that time.
It had to be, because for me with my situation, and we've talked about the issues I had with after my daughter's transition from cancer over 22 years ago, just watching her go through a cancer battle, whenever I hear anybody else, even I hear brain tumor, I automatically go back to my own situation and the situation of other individuals who have been in the same boat as me. So when I heard from you that your tumor was not cancerous, it was like a relief for me, because it's like we become a part of a community, whether we want to or not. Whenever we have a loved one who has either survived cancer or has died or transitioned or passed on from cancer, we become part of that community. And whatever happens in that community affects us, and it gets us in touch with our own journeys. So I always celebrate when individuals have family members that have survived cancer or there's a non-cancerous tumor, because as I've told people many times, Craig, I would not wish what my family went through or what I went through with my daughter Janine's cancer battle. I wouldn't have wished that on my worst enemy. And at the time, I knew who my worst enemy was. And I would not have even wished it on them.
Yes. Yes, cancer is a wicked disease, and I certainly hope that more advances in the medical system are able to ultimately find a cure for it. But we certainly hear about cancer more and more often, don't we?
We sure do, and I think the fact that as we get older, the things that are probably more likely to kill us are going to be heart disease and cancer. I think it's more important for individuals to have their final affairs in order because of that. Speaking of which, I know you're in Canada. What percentage of the population in Canada has their final affairs in order?
Well, the statistics continually prove in this country, Dave, that only about half of the adult population has a current and valid will. Many of those are so out of date that they will pose problems at the time they're needed. And far fewer of the population has a medical directive in place. And as I stress within my book, that this problem also exists in many other countries, the United States, the UK, Scotland, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, and Asia too. And for all the reasons that we have discussed previously, but you know, problems have existed for far too long, but I think it's high time that we can change this. We just have to have the courage to talk about these sorts of things and know, have a better understanding of the rules and how they apply to us and what happens if we do nothing.
And the consequences of doing nothing to me are worse than that, and we need to be able to do something. We need to have a plan. And, you know, I've heard of families and, you know, that have been just torn apart because their loved one didn't have end of life planning. And there were all these disputes in terms of who's going to get what, who's going to get what percentage of the estate. Well, you know, Grandpa promised me this. No, Grandpa promised me this. And there's a whole bunch of battling over possessions and over an estate, which has torn families apart. And for me, life's too short to be caught up in really what's going to turn out to be insignificant details. We're not going to take material stuff with us when we pass on. So, I mean, it's just, you know, get your affairs in order, make sure you have a plan, and it's going to be better for the surviving family members in the long run.
Yes, yes, absolutely. The core message that I have learned to stress in any conversations like this, Dave, when I'm speaking to others about the importance of overall planning and what I've learned, I stress to people that end-of-life planning helps reduce the stress of aging. And that's a big point just on its own. But on top of that, end-of-life planning tends to leave survivors more financially and emotionally resilient. It leaves them in a place where they are more likely to get along and less likely to contest final wishes. It naturally results in more meaningful legacies because of the planning. Yeah. It often helps charities because of the significant tax benefits of planned giving. It takes immense pressure off the courts from otherwise being forced to deal with so many unorganized estates. And all these things cumulatively help bolster the economy. It's a massive win for everyone. Yet so many people just don't do it.
Yeah, and I would think it would, you know, would end of life planning would help reduce the stress of aging. How does that work specifically? How does end of life planning reduce the stress of aging from your experience?
Well, not that I'm a psychiatrist or a psychologist or anything along those lines, Dave, but from the information that I've read and the people that I've spoke to, facing our mortality and planning around it just gives us that immense and unique peace of mind, knowing that if something, well, not if, but when something happens to us, that our family members, those that we love and care about most, will be okay. And that's really one of the major fears of estate planning, along with the aspects of it being complicated and not knowing where to turn and not being familiar with the rules and regulations and so on. But as humans, we crave control. We learn that from the time that we discovered the word no as a child, totally, with our parents. Mm-hmm. And it continues throughout our lives. And it's no wonder that more and more people now want to have this control during their final chapter of life.
And it's kind of, if you look at it, it's kind of like an oxymoron to try to have control over something you don't have any control over. I mean, we never know when death's going to come upon us. We never know when serious illness is going to come upon us. But yet we try to control that outcome. And if we can embrace death as a part of life, we're going to learn how to live and we're going to become more engaged. And I think in and of itself, if we do end of life planning, and we realize that we can use the knowledge of our death to lead a more meaningful life, we are going to become more engaged. And I believe that's also how we successfully age. And I think research has shown that the more engaged that we can become in life, the more involved we are with our community, it increases longevity, it reduces stress, it gives us meaning, and it does preserve our legacies. And if we have end-of-life planning, the families can now just concentrate, as you mentioned, on just making sure that legacy of their loved one is honored and is passed on without the stress of worrying about financial incidentals.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And as you were mentioning these things, I can't help thinking about the teaching journey. I think this is one of the ultimate teaching journeys of our entire existence. And yes, end-of-life planning, generally, end-of-life planning often involves deeply profound conversations with our family members and the advisors that are ultimately helping us. And that's what I stress also to financial advisors, how critically important is that it is for them to deeply engage with their clients in regards to these issues. As a certified financial planner, I'm not that I'm working in that role anymore, but as a certified financial planner, those professionals are mandated to cover off all the various things that could ruin a good retirement, as an example. And a critical illness or a severe stroke or a disability or certainly a premature death could ruin a good retirement. Yet there are some financial advisors out there who are reluctant to talk about these things. And that's why I've come up with some tools to help people have more meaningful conversations.
Can you share a couple of those tools that you have developed so individuals can have more meaningful end-of-life conversations?
Yes. On my website, donotignoreyourmortality.com, under the resources section, anyone can find, quickly, two particular items. The Living Legacy Quiz is a very brief quiz that anyone taking this will likely learn that they have some homework to do and they're not as organized as they would like to be. The percentage of people that I typically see, Dave, who really have their affairs in order in this regard is very, very low. It requires updating and staying on top of things. I know it's one of the easiest things to put off, and one of the easiest things not to discuss, yet we are far better off to discuss them for all the reasons we cited. But the other resource is the probing legacy questions, and they are 30 curated questions, half for beginning conversations and the other half for more advanced conversations, but they're free to anyone and they are very helpful.
And I'll make sure your website information gets put in the episode notes when our podcast drops on YouTube and the other podcast platforms that the Teaching Journeys podcast is found on. So that information will be in there, Greg.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. What is the death positive movement? I know that's something that's very meaningful for you. What is it? How have you been involved with it? And what can we learn from that?
When I started working as a funeral director back in the 80s, I had actually joined the death positive movement and I wasn't aware of it. The movement is focused on teaching and inspiring people to lean into proactive planning. Yep. We can't avoid death. But we are far better off, as you and I had briefly discussed here already, that we are better off to accept the fact that, yes, we will die. We could become incapacitated along the way, and we're far better off to put plans in place. And that's why the whole retirement planning movement within the financial advisor community and even the legal community about being prepared, succession planning with a business, and all these aspects of taking control. Having the plans in place based on our personal goals and objectives are far better off than just leaving it as is and relying on the rules and regulations of our jurisdiction to therefore apply when something happens. It's like being proactive with a prenuptial agreement or a marriage agreement or a rental agreement. Any type of agreement that we put in place, we can opt out of the jurisdictional rules and have our own rules in place. And we're far better off to be proactive in that way. And that's really what the death positive movement is about, because there are so many benefits.
I agree. It's better to be proactive than reactive, and then get into crisis intervention mode when your loved one dies, and then you realize that there's the financial planning, the end-of-life planning, the estate planning, family members, and in dealing with the stress of their own grief, are dealing with the stress now of putting the details in order when they may not be cognitively or even have the physical energy to do so.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I certainly want to stress during this conversation with you, Dave, for your audience, is the fact that it is vitally important for your listeners to understand and appreciate that the only way that they can dictate or specify who is to wrap up their life is to have a valid will. If we die intestate without a valid will in place, the jurisdictional rules of where we lived therefore apply, and basically the courts therefore are then involved in the estate settlement process. And any time we can keep the government out of our affairs, the better off we are, generally speaking. And the government wants us basically to take more control in this regard, and more people need to.
As someone who has worked for state government for 27 years in the field of addiction, I can attest to the fact that it's best if we can keep government out of our affairs and grant ourselves the autonomy and the empowerment to determine how our end-of-life chapter is going to look and how our legacy is defined.
Yes. I fully agree with you, Dave. The other thing that I reinforce, stress to people within my book and in all these types of conversations is the other aspect of how soon these types of plans will be needed. No one can predict the future. No one has a crystal ball to be able to determine what's going to happen or what tomorrow will bring. But it's vitally important that people consider the fact that their will, as an example, could be needed much sooner than what they're thinking. And from my perspective, working on the front lines of the death care industry, including a time when I worked as a supervisor at one of the largest mortuaries in this entire country, that in one way or another was involved in over 100 deaths per day, these things can happen very, very quickly. And I have spoken with many, many surviving family members who have made all kinds of comments to me over the years along the lines of, we didn't expect this to happen. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind, even when I hear it in the news about a sudden death taking place. Well, that's the way sudden death works. It can happen quickly and people often don't expect it. We're better off to be prepared and hope that we don't need it for a long time.
Absolutely. And I think as soon as we get married, or even when we're single, we should have a will in place, and then we can update that will with a good attorney, good estate attorney, good financial planner as our situation changes. Speaking of which, and I wanted to ask you this question. This just occurred to me in our conversation. What makes for a good financial planner? If I was looking for a financial planner, what characteristics would you suggest that I look for that will set that financial planner apart from the rest?
Well, the financial advisor needs to have a good reputation, needs to be upfront, honest, detail-oriented, and preferably someone that is referred to you. I often suggest to people that they ask their family members and friends who they deal with. And there are many great financial advisors out there, Dave, that do some excellent work with their clients, et cetera. And that industry is changing just like the financial planning industry, about things like fees and transparency and all these different aspects. But it often comes down to a personality match too. And it can be very wise for people before choosing a financial advisor or an accountant or a lawyer for that matter, or even a mechanic, is to speak to a few of them. And many of these types of people will quite openly let you have a conversation with them or get to know about their work and their experience within that particular space that you're looking to have them help you with.
So it would be okay for individuals to seek out a variety of different opinions with financial planners and be prepared with questions to ask as well, too.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. I truly do think that that is the best way to go, as opposed to just going with perhaps the first advisor that they're thinking of perhaps using, because I think we're better off, Dave, to have good, solid relationships in our life where we can rely on that relationship and get to know that person and deal with that person over the longer run, where they really get to know us. I think that has many benefits.
I agree. And I think whether you're a financial planner, a college professor, any walks of life, if you're working with individuals, if you want them to keep coming back for advice, for counsel, for services, you need to focus on building a relationship first. If you build a relationship, the bottom line and the demand is going to take care of itself.
Right, right. And that reminds me of the aspect of online services now, which are very much transactional for a lower cost. And as we all know, we get what we pay for typically in life. But it has me also thinking about another important topic that I bring up within my book, is that it is absolutely the case that anyone can set up a will online these days, and there are several will-making platforms, but as I stress within my book, there are cautions with that, and setting up a will online is certainly not for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I would think it would have to be a pretty reliable template that was developed by a pretty reliable firm, and I'm sure will requirements or the requirements for a will vary from state to state in the United States. And I'm sure from province to province in Canada, there may be different requirements that going online may not make us aware of.
Yes, yes, absolutely. The cost for setting up a will online typically is very, very low compared to having a lawyer set up a will for you. But again, you get what you pay for. But it's vitally important, Dave, that people understand that any type of will-making platform online has to produce the will document that is will be accepted for the jurisdiction that they're basically living in.
Yep.
The other important thing to keep in mind is that if anyone is involved in a business of any sort, they should be seeing a lawyer instead. If they're paying any support payments to an ex-spouse or in regards to child support, they should not be doing it online. They should be seeing a lawyer.
Yeah.
Or if they have any specific rules or stipulations that they want in their will that are maybe out of the norm, or if they have a disabled child or they own property outside of the jurisdiction, they should be seeing a lawyer.
Yeah, the more categories that we need to deal with as individuals or a family, the better off we are getting a competent estate attorney or a probate attorney to really help us make sure that all of our affairs are in order. There are certain things you can cut corners on, but certainly end-of-life planning is one that I wouldn't want to cut corners on. And my mother always said, don't be penny wise and dollar foolish. I think in the long run, you make the investment, it prevents you from putting in more money after.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. We're better off to be prepared. And I think it is one of the things in life that, as with many, I guess, that we're better off doing them right the first time. And not that setting up a will where it's basically a one-time event and it's done. These things need to be updated and reviewed. And it used to be the rule of thumb was to review your will every 5 years. But now with more and more digital types of platforms and recording all this information, it should be reviewed more often and discussed with family members, I think, on a frequent basis.
Now, I don't think there's a time frame. I think you review it when your situation changes, a different category arises, or let's say if you've end up adopting another child or you take in another family member because of a catastrophic event, all of that, I think, requires updates.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And the jurisdictional rules can change from time to time as well. And again, that's where an experienced lawyer who is very much in tune with those particular potential changes can be of immense value to people to make sure that their affairs truly will be up to date with their needs. But also discussing these things with family members and making sure that they are fully aware of what the the will maker wants is vitally important too.
Absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to backtrack for a minute because I know you were also a funeral director as well. And I have to throw out kudos for funeral directors. I deal with a lot of funeral directors in my own hometown. And what they do is grossly misunderstood. It isn't just about making arrangements, doing calling hours. It's about dealing with families at their worst and dealing with situations that sometimes even lawyers couldn't even begin to figure out. And the thing is, I want our listeners to know is that being a funeral director is much, much more than just doing the planning. It's, for me, a good funeral director deals with families in crisis, and they make it easier for me to provide support to them because they've done the crisis management work. And also they continue to follow up with aftercare, and they're a viable part of the community. So I needed to throw that out there because, again, I think in many ways, being a funeral service is a very misunderstood profession.
Yes, I agree, Dave. And it's something that what you've just said resonates with what I've experienced too. There are excellent people that I've met over the years in the funeral industry, but it also has me thinking about the negative side of the funeral industry that is currently being exposed on HBO, I think it is right now, with a new series called The Mortician, and about a particular fellow within that industry who took advantage of families. And I, from my understanding, that's getting a lot of attention right now in the television world. A lot of people are tuning into this, but that is certainly something that is far and few between. And it's that, and I know it's sensationalized, et cetera, but I do think that the funeral industry does provide a lot of value for families, but that too is under a lot of change because the people aren't necessarily wanting the same type of traditional funerals as they have in the past.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's an evolving industry, and, you know, there's a lot of things I think, correct me if I'm wrong, are now done online as far as purchasing products. The funeral salesman, I think, might be kind of a thing of the past now, and it's, everything is pretty much done online. And I also know funeral directors are also getting pressured to buy a lot of stuff that maybe they don't need. So there's a lot of things going on within the industry that, again, it's evolving, but like with anything, there's good and there's bad. You just have to figure out where the good lies and avoid the bad.
Right. And that bodes well also for this whole theme of planning ahead and being prepared. If people listening to this podcast of yours, Dave, better appreciate the fact regarding knowing what the options are, as an example, in regards to end-of-life care and such, not just from a hospice point of view, but the funeral side as well. There are so many great services out there. Yet it really comes down to what the individual wants. And I know we can't predict these things, how our life will play out, if we'll be lingering in some sort of facility or a hospice for a lengthy period before we ultimately die, or if it could be sudden. But again, we are far better off to discuss these things with our family members about what is important to us, our values, and the legacy that we want carried on after we're gone, and these various things, the memories, the pictures, and all these sorts of things, it can tend to pull families together as they talk about them, and it's all beneficial.
Absolutely. And when we talk about the things that we fear the most, it has no hold over us anymore. It becomes manageable.
Yes.
You have made a lot of great suggestions about being organized and what family members need to do. Are there any other first steps that you want to recommend that you didn't get an opportunity to, for families to be better organized when it comes to end-of-life planning?
Yes. I suggest, Dave, that listeners be more open to having these types of conversations with those that they love, because that is truly the first step. And it's a message that I stress within the first chapter of my book, which is simply called Communication. If people are more willing to discuss and be open to having these types of conversations, although they're difficult, and some family members won't necessarily even want to talk about them. I've seen that many times. But it's important to be patient and persistent, and I provide strategies within my information to continue to bring up these sorts of things and the timing of them so that ultimately these things can be put on the table and openly discussed and bring family members together. And if any of your listeners are wanting more information about that, they can easily contact me through my website, donotignoreyourmortality.com, where I can help give ideas and suggestions, or they can engage my services to help them.
And they can also purchase your book through there if they so choose.
Yes, that's right. The book is available through my website. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple, iTunes, and it's also available in audiobook format too.
Yeah, because I know the trend is a lot of people like to listen to their reads as opposed to sit down and read a book, just because of, you know, the demands of the go-go-go society that we live in. And people just like to walk and listen. They like to walk and listen to podcasts. They like to walk and listen to good audio books. So it's great. And again, I'll make sure all of that information gets into the episode notes. So what improvements, as we're kind of wrapping up our time together, what improvements would you like to see as far as in the whole end of life and estate planning arena?
I'm actually part of a coalition that is in the initial stages of lobbying the government to make the estate settlement process easier for people, especially by leveraging technology. It seems in this part of the world, the different layers of government don't necessarily talk to one another. And when families with the aging demographics and the death rate going up, it's going to be an increasing issue for more and more people trying to settle the estates of loved ones to do it effectively if these challenges or roadblocks are in the way. But these types of improvements can also help reduce identity theft, elder abuse, and make many other improvements to ultimately make it easier for people.
And also, I know that in the Australia and UK, there you see that there is greater openness to discussing those issues as well, too, than we're perhaps seeing in the rest of the world?
Yes, that's what I'm hearing from some of the people that I communicate with from those areas, and I'm certainly hearing that from other people that I'm connecting with.
What is the difference, do you think, in terms of what you've heard as being the difference in terms of how they discuss these issues as opposed to other parts of the world?
Well, I think that really the death positive movement is more advanced in other parts of the world, like Australia and the UK, where there's more of an open mindset around mortality and an openness to discuss these things, because the benefits of doing so are I think, better understood.
That makes sense. And also, you believe increased in organ donation is also something that we need to consider as well, too. And how does that work in Canada, and how do you become an organ donor?
Well, it used to be here in Ontario that people needed to sign the back of their driver's license, but now it's all electronic, where people can sign up that way, but to have particular organs or any tissue donated, and there is an immense need for this. Organ donors are needed all the time. I think a lot of people don't appreciate the fact that organ and tissue donation can be basically done at any age. There's a pre-screening process that is done at the time of death, and that applies also for someone looking to donate their body to science for anatomical study and so on for the medical community. But these sorts of things, again, need to be discussed openly with family members, so that they know what the person wants, so that when that time comes, it can be organized properly and preferably be well documented and planned for in advance. So again, they know what the rules are and the stipulations to be able to have it organized properly.
And you know, the other thing that comes to mind is if a family isn't going to be supportive to talk to the individual who wants to address these issues regarding end-of-life planning and death openly, there's always death cafes, which are all over the United States and all over the world. And there's also death dinners where individuals just come, share a dinner, and they just talk openly. They ask questions about mortality salience in terms of what do you think is going to happen after you die? Have you done some estate planning? Have you given thought to what your end-of-life will is going to look like? That kind of information. So even if the family members are not supportive at this point, they may be down the road, there may be other outlets that individuals can avail themselves of to get the support that they need to talk about a very difficult topic.
Yes, yes, absolutely. There are more and more people getting involved in this space all the time, Dave. And again, that's something that I'm finding. I'm being asked more and more frequently as well, whether to be involved in webinars with people who want to elevate this message in conjunction with theirs to expand their message or attract more to their audience, or be involved with people or families one-on-one to help initiate these conversations and help people realize the vital importance of just leaning into this while minds are clear and time is plentiful. Because the absolute worst time to be having these forced conversations is, as I stress within my book, when somebody is hospitalized and not doing well. It's almost taboo to bring up these things at that point, and who would want to?
Well, and again, the person who is being hospitalized or is gravely ill may not be in any position physically or cognitively to begin to talk about, you know, those type of, you know, very important issues. So the time to do it is before, you know, you end up getting sick and before you enter your end-of-life chapter.
Yes, and some people say end-of-life planning should not be done at the end of life, and I fully agree with that, Dave. Again, getting back to this point of timing, we don't know what's ahead of us, and we hear about this in the media and online all the time about accidents happening, car crashes, planes going down. Any of us could be gone at any given moment, and having our affairs in order is just such a huge benefit. I think it's one of the ultimate gifts for those that we love.
And I agree with that wholeheartedly. And boy, you've left us with a lot of good information today. I think our listeners are going to be quite happy. I think they're going to be very, very impressed with the depth of information you've given with end-of-life planning, the importance of financial planning. But I'm going to ask this question, as I ask of all of my guests, if there's one other thing you could leave us with today, the ultimate takeaway today, what would that be, Greg?
I took a lot of time to put this book together. My publishing coach recommended that I recruit beta testers, readers, people who would give me feedback as I created this book, and I did that. I recruited over 25 people from my target market. None of them were from the financial, funeral, or legal industry, but they were everyday people who had lived through these things and wanted to help others. And they provided me immense feedback as I created this book. Do Not Ignore Your Mortality, Practical Advice from a Funeral and Financial Insider. And it is proving to be a winning tool to help people realize the vital importance of leaning into these things. So if any of your listeners know of others who do not have their affairs in order as they should, and there's a lot of them out there, my book is an excellent tool for that, to help them get motivated to lean into these things while they can.
Yeah, and I would suspect, too, that it's a very easy, practical guide to estate planning and end-of-life planning.
Well, it is, and it's really a conversation starter, Dave. It doesn't get into the weeds of tax strategies or... It talks about the fundamentals of the funeral and the financial industry, and stresses many of the issues that can bubble up without planning done properly. And there's a good glossary at the back that talks about terms and definitions from both industries too.
Yeah, and those are the kind of books I favor, those that have good practical strategies. They have glossaries to define, you know, some legal terms which may otherwise be unclear, or estate planning terms, which may otherwise be unclear. So I will recommend to my listeners that they check out your book, they buy it and use it as a guide for estate planning and for end-of-life planning, and before they get to end-of-life.
Yes, yep, exactly. And your listeners should also know that I have conversation coasters too. So I'm trying everything I can to get these conversations going. My logo, Do Not Ignore Your Mortality, is on one side, and on the other side is the word to it. And I'm having a number of financial advisors buy these Cork conversation coasters from me, using them on their desk as they're speaking with their clients about retirement and post-retirement planning. And if they don't bring it up, they talk about this whole aspect of mortality. It's a great reminder, because people will often ask about the logo. But when they get the objection that the client is not ready to do this or that, or buy the life insurance that they say that they need, or set up the will that they should have. And we've all heard the phrase, I'll do that when I get around to it. The advisor will often pick up the coaster, flip it over, and say, well, look, Mr. Client, you've now got your round to it. What perfect time to get started.
Yeah, and you know, I think there's an old Buddhist saying, and I'm probably going to paraphrase this, is that we think we have time, and then there's none.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And it's always too early to talk about death until it's too late.
Absolutely, and again, if we can understand that our life on Earth is temporary, embrace our death as a way to lead a meaningful life, it's going to make those conversations and end-of-life planning go much smoothly. It's still going to be a difficult topic, but it's going to be something that's going to be more accessible because we've made it a point to make it accessible to talk about it.
Right. And one other point I want to briefly stress, Dave, is also the fact that the tax and financial benefits of estate planning are only available typically while we're alive. After our death, all strategies and ways of saving our family money to create more money that is available for those that we love as opposed to for the government. And I haven't met anyone yet who wants to really give more money to the government, but those strategies and concepts and such go out the window upon our death. And again, that's another big reason for estate planning because it's very much tax motivated.
It sounds like we've got all bases covered, the social, the financial, everything that's covered with the benefits of estate planning. Greg, thank you so much for being a great guest contributor to the podcast. I enjoyed our conversation, and hopefully we can do this again in the future.
Yes, thank you, Dave.
My pleasure. And with that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.